Session 5.
Okay, we'll do a meditation. One of the most important things to do before you start meditation is to clear your nose, really. Okay, so you can tell a New York student, you know. And then when you're ready, watch your breath. Okay. And take refuge. There are many, many kinds of refuge. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Lama. And we'll take refuge in death meditation. So think about how it can protect you. How it can save you from a wasted life. and think about bodhicitta, the real essence of it is to become yourself perfectly happy so you can teach other people how to do it. So I think in this case we'll think about how happy are you, and could you make yourself happier? Then you'd be able to teach better other people how to be happy. That's the real essence of bodhicitta, not so much giving people things. Now invite your lama or some other holy being to meditate before you, a little bit higher than you. And think about some good qualities they have that you admire. And it's not wrong here to imagine that they're perfect in that quality. Maybe you don't see them that way. Maybe they're not that way. But it's good for you to imagine some kind of perfect quality in another person. And so take a quality that you admire that you think is pretty good in them, and then imagine that they're perfect in that, and then admire that in your mind. Now make them some offering. Either visualize something very beautiful, like a beautiful song, or birds, or something beautiful to see, like a tree, or the sun, or a child's face. And then if you feel like it, sometimes make the offering of your practice, something you're doing well, or something you're trying hard if you're not doing it too well, or something small you can do later today that you'll offer to them. And that's the sweetest offering. And then next, think of something negative you've done or said or thought about someone else in the last few hours. And make it very specific and try to play it back like a video recorder. And exactly where were you, exactly what did you say, exactly what did you think. And I think usually that's enough to regret it. And then equally for something good you did today so far, something good you thought, and be very, very specific, even if it's a small thing. But it's not much use if you're not specific. Play the tape back and be happy. And ask for teachings, formal teachings. Ask that you understand the teachings and that you're able to put them into real practice. And then ask for all the little teachings that people give around you. It's very possible that the person who hurt you the most in the last 6 months is an enlightened being trying to make you understand karma or try to get you to be serious about your renunciation or teach you something about your pride or your ego. Imagine that. Now, make a prayer that all the holy lamas and other beings stay in our world, His Holiness, Dalai Lama, Lama Sopa, Lama Uso, all the other great lamas. Pray for their long life, that they stay near us, and then for the health and long life of all the your Dharma brothers and sisters in this place. You may not love them all the time, but if you didn't have this place and you didn't have them, you would be a much worst person. that completes the preliminaries, and now you can scratch that itch and stretch your leg out, and we'll start the real meditation. When you're ready, go back to your breath. Then we'll start death meditation. Go through the 9 steps, the 3 main divisions, and the preliminaries, which have 3 in them also. So really, so far we have 12 different meditations. And you can walk through and stop at whichever one you want when you do it by yourself. So first we're coming out of the forest, loaded down, dirty, tired, bent under all sorts of junk on your back. Your clothes are dirty, heavy. I see like fatigues, you know. And then you're coming to this table. People are milling around and fighting for things on drinks and food on the table. And some of them are grasping at the things on your back, and you're pushing them away from the table and trying to get what you want and hurting people. And this represents your life as you will lead it if you don't meditate on death. Then making your way out of the crowd and breaking away from the crowd and walking across the drawbridge, and there's a water below, and you're throwing things off and getting lighter and lighter as you go. And don't just throw things down in the water. Make sure you equate them to something that you do. Try to pick at least one thing in your life that you would like to divest, one possession or one relationship which is not very holy, spiritual. And then maybe some activity that you do that's not really necessary for your happiness. And you're just divesting things that take up your time, fill up your time, fill up your money, fill up your thoughts unnecessarily, and you're divesting as you cross the bridge. This represents the benefits of meditating on death. That automatically you'll want to give up some things like that. And then you see at the end of the bridge these terrible soldiers, like with swords and knives, and you break through them. This is a wrong death meditation. This is a being afraid of death or regretting death when it comes, or feeling bad about thinking about dying. And you break through that kind of conception about your death, and you break out into the meadow. And you're dancing across the meadow, and you're dressed in very, very light silk. Not even like clothes, but just like cloths. And then you're dancing across the field, and you feel light and happy and vibrant, excited. And this is the real death meditation. This is where you want what you want your death meditation today to be, to lead you. So this has two parts. You break through the wrong death meditation and the wrong way of looking at your death, and into this excitement that you are always acting as if you were going to die tonight, and you've stripped your life down to the most holy, most exciting practices you can do, and you're not tied down with a lot of other things. You come to a large door in this building with a large, it has a courtyard in the middle that you're trying to reach. A sunny, beautiful courtyard, warm, blue sky. But you're on the outside and you have to go through the building, and you come to a large oak yellow door, and you stand and look at it for a minute. And this represents the first of the great three divisions of death meditation, which is meditating how certain it is that you're going to die. And you go in the door, and immediately on your right is a huge, violent animal chained, and would like nothing better than to rip out your throat and kill you. And if it got away, it would. And this is your own karma, your own death, and it's unstoppable. If you can't practice, then it will kill you. next to the center of the room. I see it as a circular room, and there's a pedestal, a stand, and on top of the stand is an hourglass, and you look at it and you remember this means that your life is continually leaking away. I think as you get older it seems to accelerate, or more busy it seems to accelerate, and there's never any pause. It's always leaking away. No time to rest. You can't take a rest. You can't take a break. Whether you're active or whether you're sleeping, your life is leaking out, nothing coming in to replace it, and sooner or later it will be emptied. Then walking quickly, running down a corridor, it's like a little bit dark. There are pictures of your great lamas, great teachers, the things they've taught you, like portraits with lights over them, and you're running by and you don't have time to remember what they taught you. You don't have time to practice it. You just don't have enough time in your life. So even while you live, you have not enough time to practice the things you'd want to and should. And we think of that as you run down the corridor. Think of some of the specific teachings you had that you didn't have. They were wonderful. They were great. They were life-saving, and you didn't have time to do them, and you rushed on to the next thing. Then you come to a green door at the end of that hall, and it represents the fact that it's not sure when you'll die. Even though death is sure, the timing is not sure. And look at the door and remember. And you come in and you look down to your right, there's a garbage can. In the garbage can is a piece of paper with a big 72 printed on it. And then you remember, this represents the lie that there's an average lifespan that you can, they call it life expectancy, which is, the word expectancy is a lie. You can't expect anything. You don't know. You may die tonight, this afternoon. And look at it and remember. And then on through the room with some of your familiar objects in your life, your car, your bed, chair, stairway in your house, glass door on your patio door, which have all killed people and kill people every day. And then you're walking through and you're looking at them, and each one is like a bomb. And you're wondering which one it will be that will kill you. And somewhere in the mess, there's a little piece of pizza or little sandwich, very few things keep you alive. Many things can kill you. Even the sandwich is 50-50. On towards the end of the room, which is like a triangle, an elongated triangle, and then just before you reach the red door, you step on a small thorn or a splinter, and you stoop down and take it out of your foot, and a little droplet of blood comes out, and you think about how fragile your body is. And those two true stories of you know, especially the one of the young man at Sarah that I saw, who died from that. Just a small poke on his leg, and then got infected, and then he died while I was there. And our bodies are like that, very fragile. Remember that thing about AIDS, one small virus entering your body. Remember the thing about cancer, one random ray of sunlight, the radiation from the sun or of a wall, just breaking one little tiny cell in your body, a small part of one cell, and then you have cancer. You go through the red door and you open it, and there's this long corridor with an arched ceiling, and it's made of glass. And then there are objects in the room, and then there's a glass outside, I see a frosted glass on the outside and sunlight coming in. And then between the glass of the hallway and the glass of the outside wall, what is the first thing? Friends and relatives on each side, and they're talking to each other and laughing and touching each other's arms, and they're not thinking about you, and you're like, first you're like ticking on the glass, and then you're knocking on the glass, and then you're banging on the glass, and they can't hear you, they can't see you, you can't take them with you, you will be alone. Then as you walk halfway down this rectangular room, then there's on each side are all your favorite possessions. For me, like some favorite photos or books or discs or... And I'm looking out and they're all disheveled, and it's as if I haven't been there for a while, and I'm trying to reach them and I can't reach them. And then I realize I can't. I'm dead. I'm already in the bardo and... frustrated, angry, and can't reach them. No power over them anymore. And then at the very end of the hallway, behind the glass to the right, your own body, naked, on its back, and the face like featureless, which represents you. You will lose even the body that you took so much care to work for and keep healthy and keep dressed and keep fed and keep sleep. And now it's worthless there lying, and you can't really remember who you were very clearly. Then you have in front of you a white door, same size as the other, big, set in like a solid wall. And this represents the decision that you'll have to make after this meditation. Three decisions to be made. And look at the door and remember, it means three decisions you will make. And you open the door, and you're in a very small round room that's a turret, and there's like a tower going up, and there's like slits for windows, and there's sunlight coming down into the room, into the center, but you're not in the sunlight yet. And then to your left, this time to your left, leaning against the wall is a long staff of wood, very strong wood. The staff is even a little higher than your body, but it fits your hand well, and it looks familiar. And you take it with your left hand, and taking it represents the first decision, which is, if it's sure that I'm going to die, then I'm deciding to start my practice. It's my decision is to start my practice. That's taking up the staff in your left hand. And then you take one step forward towards the circle of sunlight, but you're not in it yet. And you slam the bottom of the staff down on the ground, and you hear this sharp noise. And that represents the second decision, which is to do it now. Start your practice now, today. Start the process of thinking and acting as if you were going to die tonight. And that's a response to the second room, the second division, which is that you don't know when you're going to die, so you have to start now. And when you hear the sharp rap of the stick on the floor, then remember that. You have to start now. And that's a response to not knowing when you will die. Each time, by the way, you're stepping forward with your left foot. Then you step forward again with your left foot, and you're in the sunlight. And you take the stick up, the staff, and hold it in front of you up high, like with some kind of power. And that represents that, given the fact that nothing else can help you when you die, this is what you will do, this one practice. You decided to concentrate on one thing, and that's your spiritual life. And holding the staff up high and looking up to the sun represents, this is the one thing I will do now with my life. I'll practice. I will do the holiest practices I can find. And I'll cut away all the useless things I do, and I'll even start to cut away the practices I do which are not as powerful and not as likely to get me enlightened quickly. Even those people who've decided to do Dharma have to continually move up the ladder of practices and try to go ahead as strong and as quickly as you can, because you have your responsibility to others. So you hold it up high and decide to concentrate on your practice, only your practice, and only the practices that are the most powerful you can do at that time. Then you look to the right, and there's a door, a navy blue, I'm sorry, sort of a royal blue, okay? Not a too dark, not too light, but a strong blue color. And you turn your head towards the right, but not your body. And then you bring the staff down in your right arm and point towards the door. And that'll be the door of our practice. And that's the practice that we're going to do. And we'll be doing that next, okay? So, come back now to visualizing the Lama in front of you, or the being in front of you. And you ask them to stay in your heart, and you always have to remember they're like thrilled by the request. They get like tingles up their spine, very happy that you asked, very happy that you had the brains to ask. Mm-hmm. And they rise up in the air, and they turn to face the same direction as you and float down onto your head. And now they're very small, 3 inches high. And then you picture that little chamber in your heart, meaning behind your heart, more towards your backbone. Like a little chapel. With a beautiful huge flower, like made of velvet, and on it a cushion of a sun, beautiful golden sun, warm. And you bring them straight down like in an elevator. By this time they're really small. I always think of the princess and the pea, and the thing in your heart is like a pea. The sizes are like a pea. From the outside, when you get inside, it's like a very beautiful, roomy chapel. Okay. And then they come down, and the light from their body is filling that chapel, and it's warm in your body, and you can feel the, like a small globe of warmth in that spot in your body. And then the light comes out from there, seeps through your blood, throughout your body. Then you're like one of the very few people in the United States who knows how to do a good death meditation, and you dedicate it to others, the good karma of having done this last meditation. And it bursts, the light bursts out of the pores of your body in needles, yellow, golden needles, and touches people around this city. And then suddenly they feel happy, and they don't know really why. Okay, then relax. Okay. Okay, I'm going to go over with this just so you have the oral lineage, okay? And it'll take about 10 minutes and then we'll have a break. And then we'll start the actual practice. Practice meaning the thing that'd be best to do if you're going to die tonight. This is called what a Buddha should do when a person is dying. And you know, it was a response to so many people dying and asking my Lama what to do. You know that we finally wrote it out, okay? So, the first, and it's a question and answer. The first question was, what should we do? How should we handle a person while they're dying, on their deathbed, you know? And
will that be handed out?
Yeah, it has not yet?
We have it. We'll give it up.
Okay.
We'll hand it out after this.
All right, great. No, you don't have to write it down. The main thing that Rinpoche emphasized was that you shouldn't disturb the person while they're dying. So not to the ambiance of the room should be like a nice French restaurant or something, you know? Like, the staff is moving around quietly and the light is down low, like candlelight or something. Seriously. And the place is fragrant and there's no clanging and people crying, and you have to ask the family to try to control themselves, and that they should get in the mood that they're trying to help the person move on in a nice way. And if there's panic in the room or violent emotions in the room or somebody screaming, don't go, you know, it'll disturb their mind. So the room should be, temperature of the room should be nice for them, like normal. They should be comfortable. You know, like not these hospital smocks on, you know, and not the, they give you one cheap little blanket. I never figured that out. That's always too light for the room. You know, give them their old quilt and let them be in that and make it quiet and peaceful and just conducive for dying well. Okay. Somebody asked me, does this mean you shouldn't try violent means like restarting their heart? You should. Okay. But I'm talking when it's clear that they're not going to be surviving. Then you make everything quiet and ready for them. My Lama's personally expressed the wish that he could die at home, and if he died, so then it would be, he thinks that would be better. Okay, if the person is a Buddhist, then talk to them quietly about religious things. You know, especially encourage them to think that their karmic slate is clean and to forgive all the people they hurt and to. All the people that hurt them, and to feel some regret for all the people they hurt, and to review all the things they might have done to someone and admit them and clear them out. And then he goes on to explain that if you, there's a selection process called Sundepa, which is not the same as Suldep or Selndep, okay? Suldep means to request, Selndep means to visualize, and Sundep means to pick your karmic seed like a lottery number. And at the point of death, you select your main seeds that determine your next life. So in theory, it's possible, what Jesus said, to be a really bad person your whole life, but if you really, truly regret it at the end, you can still have a good rebirth. And it's also possible to lead a good life, and then at the end, if things are chaotic, that you could pick a bad seed. And that was that thing in the Bible about the payment. Some guys worked all day and got paid $8, and some guys worked 15 minutes at the end, and the guy still gave him $8. And And they thought it was unfair, and he said, no, that's the way you die sometimes. That's okay. The people who worked all day are kind of assuring that they pick a good scene. And the people who get paid for the last 15 minutes are taking a risk. But it doesn't mean it doesn't work sometimes. But it doesn't work that often, okay? All right, so anyway, give them the best shot by making them calm and happy at the end, okay? Rinpoche noticed that, you know, even after the breath has stopped, they may still be alive for a while. With a lama, a great lama, it can be days. And that the way you know the difference, like when the death has really occurred or the mind has really left the body, is the release of fluids in the nose and the release of urine and feces like that. So you have to, not so much watching for pulse or breath, but you're watching for those signs, okay? And then he said, be careful not to jar the body before that. And he got very heavy on us at this point. He said, if you like touch them strongly and the mind leaves because of that, you've actually killed them. So you have to be. He got very heavy on us. You know, we're like, you know, and in the Abhidharma, it teaches that there are places the mind will leave the body from a certain place, and very important to touch the person first on the head. So very firmly on the head, and it's kind of weird because they're already rigid. Like I've done it, and they don't move. You know, I mean, normally you touch somebody in the head, there's a little movement. You know, but this is like touching something heavy and immobile, and you'll know. And so if you come across a person who's just died, or even an animal, you know, then try to touch them here strongly. It may be too late, and it may not be too late, but at least there's a chance, you know. So touch them here strongly. Huh? The Abhidharma and also many tantric texts explain that a lot of where you go afterwards depends on where the mind leaves the body. So very bad to touch them on their feet or their legs like that, and very good to touch them here strongly. Okay.
Is that so it leaves there?
Yeah. Oh. So the mind leaves from that place. Okay. And when you do like special practices called Tongkir or Poa, then you actually visualize certain syllables at the other doors of the body, the other spots of the body, to block those, so that you're forced out the right way. You see what I mean? You visualize like locks, tantric locks on the other parts of your body. You're inside and you lock the other places so that you're forced out the right way. Okay, that's another thing. Okay, is it all right to refrigerate the body? No. Okay, try to keep them out of the refrigerator as long as you can. Now, as I mentioned, in many states, it's required that the body be refrigerated quickly because of the idea of it contaminating the hospital and hurting other people. And so you have to talk with the hospital in advance. And don't be shy. And be practical. You know, you don't have to tell the person that you've talked with the hospital, okay? But if there's a chance that they can die, then go and get ready. And if they don't die, you know, it's okay. But get everything ready in advance. Talk to each shift of nurses, you know. Normally the nurses are more cooperative than the doctors, okay? My experience. You know, like the head nurse and a couple of the other nurses they'll be more likely to be, you know, they touch the patients all day long, and they're more likely to say, okay, we won't come in for 2 hours or something. Try to get at least 2-3 hours out of them. And don't be impatient. You know, somebody dies, it's an important transition for them. And give up the rest of the day, or, you know, just forget it. You know, be with them 3-4 hours. Get ready to be with them for 3-4 hours. And forget all your other things that you're supposed to be doing. And it's a very important time for them. Did you have a question?
you wait till you see the fluid, and then you touch.
Yeah. Especially, I think more common the urine and the feces comes out. You know, that's more common to see. If it gets to be a point where they're going to refrigerate the body, and you don't have a choice, then go ahead and touch it, okay? Strongly, right there. You know, just good if you're saying mantras the whole time. Okay.
A common practice is to like have a stool softener and the IV going through, so yeah, that you can't really tell if they're just if they're getting rid of urine and feces, because they are all the time for 8 hours. So is there a...
I don't have any brilliant thing to say. I just noticed that the thing from the nose is very subtle, and
subtle.
So you know,
is
for
it
me,
clear?
It's
is it
It's supposed to be some white and some red, I think. But I you know, for me it's been very subtle. It's been much easier to judge from the feces and the urine. So, but I would say, if you're in doubt, wait, as long as practical, as long as you can keep the hospital. And they will come and say, okay, that's all you can have, you know. And all right. In my experience, is it good to donate your organs after death? Remember today I said yes, very good, but make sure the body is dead. Make sure the mind is gone, okay? And that's not ideal for organs, but, you know, that make sure the person's already, mind is already passed out of the body. And then Rinpoche, I don't know if it was a joke or what, but he said, make sure that it should never be done for profit, meaning you should never be selling the organs, but we don't do that in this country yet. Okay, so, what's the Buddhist position on mercy killing or ending someone's life to prevent further incurable suffering? Now, Rinpoche has said very clearly that he doesn't want to be hooked up to all that stuff, because he wants to be able... We once went to visit a monk who was dying, and he was all hooked up, and Rinpoche said, that's very bad. You know, it's going to disturb him while he's passing, you know. And so he made it kind of clear to us that he didn't want to be hooked up to a lot of artificial means. On the other hand, he said, once a person is hooked up, it's not right to unhook them. You shouldn't unhook them. You shouldn't be the cause for them dying, even if there's no chance of them coming out of it. Okay. And the main reason, as you now know, is don't forget this thing. Okay. All right. I mean, the odds that they're going to suffer much more after dying are very high. You see, this whole thing of euthanasia depends on the concept of the mind dying after the body dies. And your whole bias towards, you know, shooting an animal who's hurt badly, the whole concept is that they'll feel better afterwards. And that's not correct. That's a fallacy. They won't feel better afterwards. Most likely they'll feel much worse. So don't, you know, forget that bias. That's a bias from a culture that believes that the mind is gone when the body is dead. You see? And we don't even make that distinction in English. You don't say, oh, when did your aunt's body die? You say, when did your aunt die? You see what I mean? And we don't make the distinction between the mind and the body. You see what I mean? So you're not doing anybody any favor. Forget that idea. It's wrong. It's not that way. You're making a very gross assumption, which is that the mind stops when the body stops. And, you know, I always tell people, there's an owner of a large insurance company that invites me to his place once a month to have a Buddhist debate. He's very, very outspoken and very rough guy. He was a longshoreman and I think they had some connection with the mafia stuff and stuff like that. He's like, yeah, you know. But he has this Buddhist streak in him, and he wants to debate. And we actually have a debate in the boardroom, you know, once a month, you know. And so he was like, prove this future life, prove it. You know, and I give him all Dharmakirti things. He says, I don't believe it, you know. And then he's a wonderful guy to debate, you know. He doesn't believe anything. No, you have to prove everything from ground zero, and which is good for me, you know. It's good for anybody. He doesn't believe anything just because you said it. It's perfect debating partner, actually. And then I said, well, goddammit, then you proved that people do die when they, you know. You know, I'm tired of trying to prove. You know, why is there this bias in America that poor old Geshe Michael has to keep proving that your mind doesn't die? You prove to me your mind does die. And there is no proof, because it doesn't actually. You see, I mean, there is no proof. There's no proof at all. This is some kind of cultural fairy tale that you believe because your mom said so, you know, and that's the only thing. If your mom had said the opposite, you'd believe that for the same wrong reasons. You see what I mean? Anyway, it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It's got to go somewhere, and most people go lower. So you're not doing anybody a favor. Yeah.
When animals die, it's also the same, right? It's better to not ever put them to sleep.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
if they're really suffering.
Yeah, because they're going to be suffering much more. Because animals' karmic credit cards are really bad. They don't know how to be thoughtfully or philosophically compassionate. They don't know how to do that. And they've mostly either been selfish or violent in their lives. And so, yeah.
When people are brain dead, is their mind still in the body?
I think Buddhism would say that if it's still breathing, then the winds are still operating and the mind is still there, but at a very subtle level, and not enough to generate electrical impulses, but still alive, okay? She said, if a person is brain dead, you know, no, I don't know what you call it, encephalogram or something? Mm-hmm. No recordable electrical activity. In Buddhism, as long as they're still breathing, then I'd say the winds are still moving. We distinguish between the manifest mind and the subtle minds. The subtle mind, I think, would still be going. Okay. So that's a difficult question. Okay. You know, yeah.
What happens to the wind in the body when the body dies?
When the mind moves, the winds leave. Because lungsam jukpa chikpa, the mind and the winds are moving in tandem. Where the mind goes, so go the winds. Yeah.
In the case where someone is hooked up to machines and they're being made to breathe,
yeah,
and the body is still functioning, but yeah, if they weren't hooked up, it wouldn't be functioning,
yeah,
on its own.
Yeah.
Is the mind still there?
Yeah, we'd say the mind is still there. And if you disconnect them at that point, you've killed them. And that's important to know. And by the way, this is a very difficult question. I never come out of a class and everyone's convinced or something like that, because it's such a gray area. But I'd say better to err on the safe side, you know what I mean? And not be responsible. I've heard people ask His Holiness, suppose this is very expensive to keep this person alive. And then in a public talk, he'll say, well, maybe you should think about disconnecting them or something like that. When he comes to Sarah and talks to the monks, that's not what he says, okay? So, the big difference between what His Holiness says to an American audience so as not to, what do you call it, alienate them completely. You know, and this is a Buddhist tradition. Lord Buddha taught Abhidharma, taught Sautrantika, and taught mind only, and taught Svatantrika, and didn't mean any of them. But had to because of the audience, okay? So, yeah.
What if before you got involved with Buddhist practice you have turned off?
Then you have to purify that karma, okay? Care for other people's lives. You know, volunteer at a hospital, dedicating that karma to wiping out that karma. And then do it for 6 months and then stop and say, finished. Decide, finished. You see what I mean? Very important. Yeah. Yeah.
If someone dies a violent death, like in a car accident,
yeah,
like if, for example, if you were with them, does the mind leave the body right away because it's a violent thing? Like, what can you do if you're with someone in a car accident and they get killed and you don't, what can you do?
If the death is very sudden and all the liquids have been released immediately, the best you can do is do some prayers. There's still, mind is still in the area, and it's going to come. It's going to come here. Okay? Yeah.
You know, when you're trying to help someone die and you're telling them to forgive the people that harmed them, what about asking them to bring up things that they regret and letting go of that? Or do you just don't even go there?
No, that's good too. That's very good too. Because it's about 50-50. They're going to have to do both before they die. By the way, if you have someone with a lingering death, my father died of lung cancer over, you know, a few months' time, then we had a good chance to talk about things and he had a chance to work out. And the closer they get to death, the more willing they are to let go of things. And that's a good chance, you know. He was not a religious person, but towards the end, he was. He saw the wisdom, I guess, with some kind of special understanding as you get close to death. You get more, like the airplane thing. And I want to talk more about that today. The interesting reaction of a plane load of people who are strangers to thinking they might die together. And there was this whole bonding thing and this love that was pouring out from everyone, and it was very noticeable. I remember the diaries of some ship captain who died in Antarctica, stuck there, and he's stuck with five people in a little tent, and they know they're going to die. There's no hope of any rescue. They're the only guys on Antarctica at the time, and they're snowed in totally, and there's no hope. And the last journal entries, they think the journal might be found. So the last entry is, for God's sake, take care of our people. It's such a, what of our last thought? You see, that's a natural human last thought, is some kind of brotherhood with other people, some kind of love for other people, you know. You feel all the boundaries break down between people, and they see humanity as one big mass. And it's weird that would be the last entry, but that's how it happened on the plane, too. You know, it's like that. Did you have a question?
Well, it might might sound stupid, but if you have like a... Well, it happened to me that somebody died that I was kind of taking care of, and then we had a fax from Mama Sopa saying he was in Vajra Yogini Paradise already. So is it okay at that point to put them in the fridge?
Yeah. If Mama Sopa sent you a telegram and a fax and says they're already in Vajra Yogini Paradise, then you could put them in the fridge.
It was like right after the death.
No, it could be that they leave a second after the death. You know. But I say don't take a chance. Why take a chance? You know what I mean? She said that they got a fax after one person had died from Lama Sopa saying this person was already in a Buddha paradise. And so could you refrigerate the body then? And I'd say sure. But if you're not sure and you don't have a fax from Lama Sopa, I'm serious, you know. If you do, then forget it. Just do what he said, you know. Yeah.
There was an instance when my grandfather fell in the shower and died, and when they found him, they...
You mean his shower killed him, actually? Seriously?
Yeah. So they moved him to put him on the bed so that he could rest there, and then waited for those signs. In that moving process, like...
Yeah, better not to touch the body. Even if the body's all crumpled up and looks uncomfortable, then don't touch them. Yeah. I mean, here. Yeah. Yeah, because by touching, you might jog the mind out. Yeah. Yeah.
I've read or heard something about 3 days.
3 days for a really person with good meditation, you know. I'd just say as long as practical. You know, if, like John, I remember at Vajrapani, it was good circumstances. He died in his house. Lots of lamas and good practitioners were in the area, and they converged on his house. And I think they did pujas for 2 or 3 days. And if there's no problem with the authorities, and I think even if there is a minor problem, I mean, they're not going to accuse you of murdering them. They're just going to accuse you of not reporting it soon enough. And usually they just let you go after that. So I think it's worth it. I think, yeah, if you could do it for 2 or 3 days, it'd be wonderful.
What are the best mantras or prayers to say while somebody's dying?
We'll get to that. It's coming. Did you have a question? No. Yeah, Rami.
These instructions on leaving the body and where to touch the body imply that somehow our action is strongly influencing someone else's karma.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like your action could affect their karma, but in reality, whether you touch them correctly or not is totally dependent on their karma. You see, whether you make the decision to touch them is their karma. You see, I mean, and I'll give you a good example. When somebody's being mugged and you decide to run to their aid, do you always save them? No. I mean, sometimes you tap the guy on the shoulder and he turns around and stabs you and then stabs the president. You know, I'm talking New York, right? And then sometimes you tap them on the shoulder and they run away. So then, but who has saved them? Their own karma. Does that mean you shouldn't tap the guy on the shoulder? No, you should.
You always do the compassionate action.
You have to, yeah. So that you can get enlightened faster to be a Buddha to help other people. It's very interesting, you see. It's like that Tonglen thing, you know.
So you're actually tapping them on the head to speed your trip to enlightenment.
Yeah.
They are being tapped on the head by you because of the karma they have.
Yeah, yeah. And if you grab their foot, it's their fault, really.
Yeah,
but you've done
karma.
A bad deed. And karma works exactly, it's a scenario. There's always the right person at the right time and the right karma at the right time. It's always like that, you know. You're doing a bad deed because probably you got used to doing them in the past at exactly the time and place that they need to have the result of their bad deeds to be touched. You see what I mean? It's always like that. And it seems unthinkable, but everything's exactly right. You know, you're there to do the bad deed because you practice in your past life, and then they're there to be the victim of the bad deed because their karma is ready to receive it. And it's always like that. It's always this confluence of two people's bad deeds. Yeah.
So if it's okay to have a living will, then to say that you don't want your life prolonged by being hooked up.
Yeah.
But if you were then in a situation where that living will, there was an accident and wasn't handy, and you did get hooked up, does that mean that your spouse or something should not?
Yeah.
carry out that?
From what I understand, yeah, that's the way you should run it. Because then you'll be responsible for them killing you, you see what I mean? I mean, you'll be encouraging them to commit a murder. That's the way Rinpoche presented it, and I think that's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Did you have a question?
I'm a hospice nurse, and I have to take care of people who are in other traditions, and sometimes families want them to have a bath right after.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's not really the ability to be, you know, we try for a while, but... it's my job to do that.
She says that her job entails as a hospice nurse to bathe. Oftentimes the tradition, the spiritual tradition of the person involved would mean that they should be washed right after, and the family wants them bathed right afterwards. And this is the same with all Buddhist morality. You know, you have to go as far as you can. You know...
I always touch them at the...
Yeah.
I've
been going
sort of gently, but...
Yeah. No, just if it looks like you're just straightening their hair or something, you know? And a lot of Buddhist morality is that, you know? A lot of Buddhist morality is that, is kind of tapke, tapzu, skillful means, you know? And yeah. And you should bathe them if it would upset the family if you didn't, and if that's their spiritual tradition, then you should try to delay as long as you can. And it, when you pick them up, you should touch them here first and mutter something in their ear and like that. That's fine. There's a very beautiful thing in the refuge instructions to monks, to fully ordained monks, and it says, if your lama is a housewife, okay, if your lama is this like enlightened housewife, and there's and you walk into a room and they're there, and you have to do your prostrations. But it would hurt the faith of other people around you to see a fully ordained monk prostrating to what they perceive as a normal housewife, and you're not in any position to explain to them who this person is. Then you should set a book down next to them and bow down to the book and sort of angle off towards the housewife. You know, and it's tapke. It's called tapke. And... The fact that that's in a scripture tells you have to be very careful about judging people's actions and what appears to be going on at a particular time. You have to be very... The only person you can really judge is yourself. And that's the goal of Buddhist logic. That's the stated goal of Buddhist logic. As they studied it in New York. If you're not enlightened or almost enlightened... Actually, it says if you're not Shakyamuni or someone like Shakyamuni, meaning another Buddha, don't attempt to judge other people because you might make a boo-boo. Yeah. And there's no benefit to it, you know. Might as well just watch out for... You can judge this one and it's messed up, so you might as well take care of that one.
A few years back, we were in Washington and Lama Zopa was there and gave the participants a scroll but mantras. All manner of different mantras. And he said that when someone died, you should be always trying to touch their face with that sheet, mm-hmm. that scroll. Have you mm-hmm. had any experience with that?
I personally have never received that instruction, but I believe it. And I think you should do it.
Yeah, he says it would almost ensure a higher rebirth.
Yeah, I think it's a great... instruction. I have a lot of faith in Lama Sopa. I think he's a very, very, very high Lama, and I think you should do it. Yeah.
Can suffering at the end of life purify negative karma?
She said, can suffering at the end of life purify negative karma? It's always the case that when you suffer, you're wearing out negative karma. Yeah.
So therefore, say the more you allow someone to suffer rather than... in the case of an animal particularly, because...
Yeah. No, that's a common question, you know. So should you not try to comfort an animal, for example, if they're suffering, because it'll give them an opportunity to wear off bad karma? No, what you should do is try to stop their pain. And if you succeed, they had the karma to have the pain run out already. You see what I mean? And if you don't succeed, they didn't have the karma to have the pain run out already. So, but in either case, your responsibility is to help people with pain. Your absolute, constant... immediate responsibility is to always help someone who's in pain, even though the pain is necessarily caused by their own bad karma. You see what I mean? So, you know, if you read this book called The Garden, you know, there's this scene where the guy says, well, who's responsible for all the pain in the world? And the other guy says, their own bad karma. So then the first guy says, well, then I should just leave them alone, right? And the guy gets furious. You know, the other guy blows up. I forget who it is. It's Dharmakirti or something. And he says, "You idiot! You know, this is the biggest mistake a person can make. It's to go from that to that. It's, I mean, it's their karma to suffer. Ergo, I don't have to help them. You know, this is like the most in Buddhism. This is like the greatest leap of stupidity that you can do, you know. from this idea to that idea, and it's such a it's a very common objection to Buddhism that if children who are burning in Kosovo, if it's their fault that they're burning, then you guys must believe that you should just leave them alone. And no, it's not that. Because it's their fault, I must help them. Get used to that idea. Okay. Yeah.
If someone is killed by being repeatedly blown on the top of the head,
yeah,
they die in that process, and then they're left for like over 5 hours without anybody touching them, does that awareness of being hit on the top of the head do anything for them?
No, I would say so. And it's their karma to be hit there. You see what I mean? Yeah. So better go through the windshield than... Okay. Yeah. Yeah. In general, I'd say, logically, yeah. Yeah.
I'm a nurse in cancer research, and we give a lot of trial drugs. Knowing that a lot of animals are given these experimental drugs and harmed and then eventually killed, do I collect some of the karma of that, even though I'm not involved with the animals, but then it comes directly to me giving it to patients?
She said she's involved in cancer research, and sometimes their company might give drugs, experimental drugs, to animals, knowing that it will kill them, to see how their effects are. Two answers to that.
Session 5 continues on the next CD.